This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Drug overdose is the number one cause of accidental death in the U.S. At the center of the drug overdose problem are painkillers known as opioids. In 2014, opioids killed more than 28,000 people. That is more than any year on record, and that's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A recent report by a healthcare research firm shows that four cities in North Carolina are among the top 25 in the country for opioid abuse. First on the list, Wilmington. Joining us now to talk about opioid abuse is Paul Nagy. He's a professor at Duke University School of Medicine. Paul Nagy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
How did this opioid abuse problem become the problem that it is?
Well, I think one way to think about this is that it came in as a perfect storm, and I think there were probably four factors that contributed to it. I think the first was that between 1999 and 2010, there was a real shift in prescribing practices to treat pain. And we saw as a result really a tripling in the number of narcotic analgesics that were prescribed during that period of time. Related to that, I think, was that in 2001, the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Hospital Organizations established a new policy that pain should be recognized as a fifth vital sign. And as a result, certainly, again, better pain management was a focus of the medical community. I think also with the aging population, osteoarthritis and so on, I think there was certainly just more sensitivity to that issue. Related to that was the pharmaceutical companies saw this as an opportunity, of course, and there were new formulations of analgesics, particularly those that were longer acting and much more powerful. And what was not recognized at the time was that those medications, when crushed, could be abused. Particularly, they could be snorted or they could be used intravenously to experience a significant euphorogenic effect. And we didn't realize that so well at the time, and it's been a number of years before we've kind of caught up to that fact. In the early days, of course, with the concerns about pain and the medications that were now available, there was aggressive marketing by the pharmaceutical companies. And in our society, we all probably know that we're kind of induced to not have pain in our lives. I mean, you know, you go home tonight, watch television, you'll be bombarded with messages that tell you whether you have a headache, hot flash, or a hemorrhoid. You know, pain is unacceptable and should be eliminated at all cost. And so, you know, in many ways, we were conditioned as a society toward, I think, better pain management. I think another thing related to this was the prescribing practices themselves, that we really weren't doing a particularly good job educating patients or the community at large, much less patients and families, about what the particular risks would be. And certainly, prescribing practices were not very restricted, that we had pretty generous refill schedules, that oftentimes people were prescribed much more than they needed, and also that adherence was not very well checked. That we weren't, for example, in North Carolina, only 6% of prescribers were accessing the Controlled Substance Abuse Reporting Center to ensure that patients weren't receiving multiple prescriptions from other prescribers.
Stop right there and go over that for me again. What does that center do, and whose responsibility is it to sort of keep that those things linked together?
So that's a clearinghouse resource so that a prescriber can ensure that a patient is not receiving same medication or some other medication that might actually dangerously interact with an opiate.
Aren't they obligated to make that? I mean, isn't that what your doctor does?
Well, we're moving toward that as a best practice, and so we are seeing increased access to that resource. But historically, we really weren't seeing much. You know, there really wasn't much attention to
that.
So
you'd go to one doctor, go to another doctor, go to another doctor,
correct,
get all these things, and nobody's talking to each other. Now you got this. And that can be even accidental, right? I mean, these are
people who don't
realize what they're doing.
Well, that's right. Or patients prescribe, for example, a CNS depressant or a benzodiazepine or something like that, and they're not understanding that there is actually a risk of death associated with that. And if the doctor doesn't know they're getting that other prescription, I mean, the classic example is, you know, family doc prescribing opiate, psychiatrist prescribing benzodiazepine, and the two physicians not communicating with each other. And in practice, by the time people come to treatment, oftentimes they've got a very extensive history of doctor shopping.
So tell me a little bit about the addiction rate then. Is this because people were prescribed painkillers and couldn't get off them? And to what extent do they make it to the street and are used by people who were never prescribed these?
Well, I think those are the other factors I could probably speak to. I think one is that these are medications that provide very reliable relief, not just for physical pain, but also for emotional pain. And so we also see a very high rate of co-occurrence between substance opiate use disorders in particular and mental health disorders. For example, people with anxiety and depressive disorders have a 4.6% greater chance of actually becoming opiate dependent. We also, in our experience, if you think about this period of time, our world, went through a lot of changes, and I think our society was very stressed. And if you think about the recession, for example, we had a higher rate of joblessness and homelessness and social isolation and all the things that would certainly draw people to seeking some kind of emotional relief. We also, in our experience at Trosa and other places, we see also that a lot of our patients have had a very significant history of trauma in their lives that have not been fully addressed, much less healed. And that's very common. I think the other thing is, if you think about our adolescent population, and by the way, prescriptions for adolescents and young adults actually have doubled during this period of time. And if you think about the developing brain, one of the things that we now have better understanding of is that at this stage of life, this age group is seeking novelty, stimulation, sensation, and pleasure. And that leads to the other part of the perfect storm, which is access. The internet made it very easy to actually obtain these medications without restriction. I think that's begun to change, but for a while, internet access was one way people
got drugs. To mention that those brains are not yet fully developed until kids are sort of in their 20s, and so you've got questions
right.
About judgment, the effect of on the brain in their development, all those questions, and that's the legal part. Well, let's find out a little bit and get a kind of a firsthand account about maybe how some of this happens. I'd like to introduce Kevin McDonald back to our show and Paul Layton, who joins us today. Kevin is the founder of the Substance Abuse Recovery Center in Durham called Trosa. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Frank. Pleasure.
And Paul Layton grew up in Wilmington and is now a resident at Trosa. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Frank.
Tell us how you became involved with opioids.
Well, as you said, I grew up in Wilmington. That's all I can really ever remember. When I started going to school, I made good marks all the way until, middle school. And I started to notice that, I didn't fit into a lot of the different cliques. And, the drug abuse, like I started using when I was 12, I started smoking marijuana. And it kind of gave me a place to fit in. Like I was there. Everybody accepted me. I paid a little bit of money, and all of a sudden I was like everybody else. And this progressed on into stimulants when I was 15. I started like the prescription pills we were talking about. I started abusing them when I was 16.
Let me stop you there for one moment. How'd you get them?
Off the street. I would talk to people at school, and they would introduce me. A lot of their parents would, they would have, like if somebody had problems with stress, they had a cabinet full of the benzos that Paul, Mr. Nagy was referring to. Yeah. Or if, they had minor back pains, they had Oxycontin, which flooded the market at a time, and I didn't know what I was getting myself into when I first started, but that's
And then you got yourself involved in a theft at one point that where things really began to escalate. Am I right?
Yeah. Eventually, I went into using heroin intravenously, so that habit progressed from like a $20 a week thing into where I had to come up with $500 a day, $400 a day. That's a lot of money, and I didn't go into college. I had all these dreams and ambitions, but like growing up, like I kind of hindered them by trying to fit in. I hindered all of that, any possibility. And so when you're using that much heroin on a daily basis, you have to find a way to get more. Mm-hmm. And so I went into theft, and that became my new profession. I would steal to provide for my habit, to the point to where I overdosed one day. Like I was using in my house and overdosed, and my little brothers found me dead And, you know, I thought that, you know, everybody thought that that would be enough, that would encourage me to seek help, you know. But it took a third-party intervention. Like I had, like you had mentioned, I stole from a guy that I loved, from a guy that, you know, my dad was in prison my entire life. You know, I was raised by my mother, and, you know, this guy provided anything I could want in a father. He was good to me, and I stole right from underneath him. Mm-hmm. And instead of, you know, bringing the hammer down on me, so to speak, he provided me an out. And I went into the treatment. I started seeking treatment, you know. And you know, throughout this journey, like, there was many different places. Like I started at these detoxes. I started going to, you know, a week. I spent a week in a place. I started going to 30 days. You know, it just progressed to the point to where, you know, this last charge I received, I knew that I needed to find somewhere that was long term, that I could hang out and work on me, and Trosa has provided that opportunity for me. They allow, you know, I don't have any responsibilities. I have to wake up and go to vocational training. You know, they provide everything. Everything's all inclusive. So I've really been provided an opportunity to stop everything that's going on and focus on why I want to shoot $500 of heroin.
Right. So to be clear, then, you have been maybe arrested a few times and in and out of various short-term treatment programs throughout your ordeal as you became addicted to heroin, and that addiction increased, and then finally sought long-term help.
Yeah.
And this was after this theft from a good friend, somebody who had really been taking you. And you were living at home at this time? I mean, your parent, your mother, you know, sort of knew what was going on with you?
Well, you know, a lot of people don't have experience living with heroin addicts, you know, and I didn't want to talk to her about. It's a shameful thing. This is something that I didn't know I was going to be doing. I'm ashamed of it. So how did I get to that point, like, to where, you know, it took her, you know, we sat down and talked about it one day, and, you know, she looked at me in the eyes and told me that, you know, she's crying and telling me that she doesn't know what to do. She just knows that what's going on right now is not going to work. You know, like, what can we do? She's asking me, and, you know, I didn't know. You know, this is before any of that other treatment came into availability for me. Like, I didn't know anything about recovery at all, you know?
Well, let me ask Kevin McDonald at Trosa, the founder of Trosa, what you're seeing in terms of opioid abuse and whether things are changing. You've been at this business of recovery for a while now. How are things changing, or are they?
They are. I mean, we're getting so many opioid and heroin users now. It's tripled in the last couple of years, how many people. And the other part is the younger the population. You know, the younger population, 18 to 24, has doubled. And the amount of people using crack has gone down comparatively. Like, in our program of 500 people, 54% have tried opiates. And that's...
And how is that? Have you seen that percentage change?
Oh, yeah. That's grown tremendously.
So you have... It's a long-term treatment program. If you make it all the way through, you're in for 2 years, right?
Right.
And, and you work your way through. And that's one of the things that distinguishes the Trosa model, is this long-term commitment and lots of activities along the way, including work toward the end. But is there anything different in your recovery model when you're dealing with opioid addicts versus other addicts, alcohol or other addictions?
Well, I think some of the evidence-based therapy we do helps, you know, not just with the opioids, but across the thing, because it's been proven. And I think that the community heals is the other part of it, that people working with each other, they know what the person has gone through, and so they can help each other with it. And I think the learning a work ethic is really important, because, you know, people go through treatment and all of a sudden they have to go back to work and they don't have a work ethic. And so training people in different skills is paramount to.
And that's one of the advantages of keeping people together for a long time.
Absolutely.
Knowing their commitment to each other. But then eventually you've got jobs, you're working it off.
Right. Well, they haven't felt a part of anything for a long time. And all of a sudden they start, you know, slowly work into being a part of something, and they're part of the process of helping other people. And anybody who's been a drug addict knows it's all about you instead of, you know, other people.
Well, Paul Layton, you talked about that. You got into drugs initially because you didn't feel like you belonged. How has the recovery, has that played any sort of reversed things for you?
I couldn't. Yes, absolutely. You know, I come here and in Detrosa, and I feel like I'm surrounded by people that I'm exactly alike. Like I'm able to identify, like, you know, the things that were once so shameful. Now I share, and it's, you know, people, I'm accepted. They know because they've been there. You know, and then now, you know, it changes into that pursuit of what can we do now.
Yeah. Well, what can we do now? Paul Nagy, let me ask you. First of all, let me talk about rural areas, urban areas. Any differences there before we move on to sort of where we're headed?
Well, actually, I think rural communities sometimes are more susceptible. I don't think we fully understand this at this point, but rural communities have certainly been significantly impacted by this issue. Sometimes it's seen as a multi-generational concern. Sometimes it's because resources are more limited for those people who might want help. I mean, there's probably a variety of factors that contribute to that. But I can tell you, you know, first of all, the kind of bad news, good news. The bad news is that this is a chronic relapsing disease, and that we have a very high rate of relapse. About 75% of those who are detoxed off of opiates actually using opiates within the next year. So very high relapse rate. So what that's informed, we actually have had remarkable advances in our understanding of how this is a complex brain disease, and that really has led to the development of a variety of treatments, both behavioral and medication-assisted therapies. And so on the side of medication-assisted therapies, we actually now have a range of medications that really help to stabilize people with opioid addictions and promote a capacity to achieve and sustain lasting recovery.
What about naloxone?
Naloxone is an opioid reversal. So this is what actually saved Paul's life, is that when he mentioned he was dead, he was clinically dead, is that with the opioid reversal opportunity, he was able to actually survive his overdose. So that's a remarkably effective medication for those people who are at risk of death. But the medications I'm referring to are more treatment-based medications, opportunities to, again, kind of, you know, save you from ever having to worry about overdose. And those in particular, they're really kind of two to mention. They're what are referred to as agonist therapies, which are known as replacement therapies. The one that people are probably most familiar with is methadone. And then there's which is what's called a full agonist. And basically that occupies the receptor that is otherwise going to be activated by an opioid. And because it's occupied, you're not likely to use. And then there's a partial agonist known as buprenorphine, which has also been formulated as a medication called Suboxone, which combines buprenorphine with the naloxone to prevent people from actually crushing that up and then abusing it, because it basically puts the person into immediate withdrawal.
But listen, I'm hearing, we've got excellent treatment programs like TROSA. There are others that, once you're in this problem, can help you out. Now you're talking about medication to help reverse the effects of medication, perhaps undo the effects that pharmaceuticals giveth and taketh away. It does seem like this is a bit of an arms race. Is there a better strategy to keep us from this precipice, which we're already tumbling off, to keep us from getting into the situation in the first place that medicine won't solve, because it seems to always find its way back into our medicine cabinets?
Well, I think we're making progress in that regard. I mean, I think for one thing, we're going from stigma to science in terms of how we understand and approach this. And so there have been a really quite a number of practice guidelines that have now been established and have been rapidly actually being implemented within the health community to try to offset the rate at which people are having access to medications that they might likely misuse or abuse. And so there have been changes in that way. We are, in fact, doing, I think, a better job. We can do more to try to educate the community and raise that awareness, and particularly, you know, work more closely with patients and families who might require medication to reduce that risk. And then on the treatment side, we still have uneven access. 13% of our population in North Carolina are uninsured. And so access to the good treatments that do work are not always easily accessible, but we're encouraged by, at least at the federal level, there are some, and at the state level, actually, the Governor's Task Force on Alcohol and Mental Health has done, Substance Abuse Mental Health has done a lot to try to advance ways in which communities can affect this problem.
I want to thank all of you for being on our program. Paul Nagy is a professor at Duke University in the School of Medicine. Kevin McDonald, the founder of the Substance Abuse Recovery Center in Durham called TROSA, and Paul Layton, a resident at TROSA. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you,
Frank.
Thank
you.
Thanks, Frank.
Coming up, an opera that pits Hercules against vampires. Stay tuned.